The search and rescue operation in Surfside has come to a halt over worries that the rest of the building could come crumbling down. This is Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. The potential reaction in state politics to the tragedy. Could new laws be in the works? President Biden is visiting the disaster scene in Surfside today and meeting with families. Plus,
the community not only being insular, dealing with our own people, so to speak, but dealing with the needs of the community at large.
The Shul of Bal Harbor is supporting the rescue workers and the families of victims. We hear from the rabbi of the synagogue about the long history of Jewish culture in Surfside. Finally, we switch gears and get an update on the future of cruising in Key West. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part with support by the Miami Cancer Institute. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. The search and rescue efforts at the site of the Surfside condo collapse have been halted since early this morning, after the remaining building was deemed unsafe. 18 people thus far have been found dead at the rubble, and two children were discovered yesterday. 145 people remain missing. President Joe Biden is in Surfside today, meeting with victims' families and rescue workers. Democratic State Senator Jason Pizzo's district includes Surfside, and he joins us now to discuss. Thanks for coming on, Senator Pizzo.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
So, Senator, how has the weather and the instability of the building impacted these search and rescue efforts at the site of this partial condo collapse?
Well, the very first day, a number of families, obviously, with anger and frustration, noted that there didn't seem to be a lot of activity because there was an assessment as to whether or not the remaining portions of the building had structural integrity to begin the search. And then, you know, this is a Miami summer, so we get, you know, afternoon rain, we've had lightning, we've had wind gusts. Wind obviously accelerates as it passes through buildings, of course. So it's hampered at times, and especially when families were able to visit. And you're watching aerials and you see that, the crews stop for a moment, but there's lightning nearby. So that's compounding the issue, of course, are a number of fires that we had the first day, mattress fires, then rug and carpet fires underneath the pile as well.
And Miami-Dade Fire Chief Alan Kaminsky did say during a press conference this morning that the search and rescue operation was temporarily halted because a column hanging from the structure was moving and there was slight movement in the concrete slabs on the south side of the building.
On the south side of the building, you can see, we visit the site every day, but on the south side of the building around the fourth floor, the floor slab completely jutted out. And that was, you know, on the first day, the situation is not getting any better. So, I mean, hats off to the brave men and women who continue to be on the pile, regardless of their own safety, to continue. But at some point you have the sheer opening side of 11 stories that stuff still faces out. You can still see half of some apartments and all of that stuff, as well as floor pieces, floor slabs, other wall sections, whatever can come down at any time.
And have you had the opportunity to speak with some of these rescue workers one-on-one about what their experiences have been like on the scene?
Just the takeaway is, they continue to be engaged and they appreciate and know that there are family members and loved ones that want closure. And a lot of things that we've seen on the scene, the details of which are really not appropriate to share, they would seem sort of rather insensitive, but it's, they're trying as hard as they can.
And what level of support have these first responders and search and rescue responders received from the state? And could more federal support be coming with President Biden's visit to Surfside today?
So the president announced, he wants to pay for it. So any and all things related to it. But we're concerned about mental health as well. And there's been several conversations around making sure that we're tending to, you know, it's not just about food and water and making sure that the tents are up and the RVs are running and porta potties are working for all the rescuers. It's also about their mental health as well. I mean, you know, it's fatigue day after day compounded by what they're actually physically seeing. So mental health is going to be a large portion. There's a number of counselors both for families. And we're also, my office specifically, we want to start shifting to a lot of the survivors as well. I think they feel, you know, they appreciate and obviously sympathize with the situation, but we have a lot of displaced people right now that don't know where they're going to be living after some free hotel stay expires.
And you've spoken to some of the families and friends whose loved ones are still among the unaccounted for. Can you tell us how they're doing now? Are they still in shock over this, grieving? Are they angry, calling for change? Like, where are they at right now?
The grief stage for many has reached anger. You know, blame and just a general impatience. And it's impossible to criticize anyone who has a loved one, you know, somewhere in a pile of rubble, and why aren't they getting to them? So, they're understandably angry at this point.
And you've made some calls of some state laws that you might like to see changed in response to this, to stop something like this from happening anywhere else here in South Florida or in another part of the state. Can you outline a little bit for us what your thinking
Sure.
is on that?
So Miami-Dade County and Broward County both have recertification processes for 40-year-old buildings, and then incrementally thereafter. But none of the other counties do. I mean, we're 67 counties, many of which hug coastlines or are on coastlines, so in waterways. So I think it's a generally decent model to have a recertification process for buildings, but they can't be considered in a vacuum. So legislatively, I would like to take in consideration the location of structures. So something that's similarly situated in the exact same building built somewhere high and dry and inland would not suffer the same type of accelerated and exacerbating conditions of saltwater intrusion, high water tables, perhaps recurrent flooding. Surfside's one of the 15 cities I represent. And year after year, we put in state funding requests for flood mitigation as it relates to roadways and storm sewers, just like our other cities. So you have to appreciate that a building itself may have design, mechanical, you know, material, building material issues and flaws, but it's only compounded and accelerated by subsurface or you know, geographic location. So we have to take that in consideration. A lot of our colleagues who have come to visit have called and asked what they can do. And my sort of retort is to keep an open mind, because you know, there are condos in Naples and Jacksonville and Tampa and even in the Panhandle that this should be considered.
And when it comes to building codes, what kind of a role do you think the state should play? Like should there be things laid out flat across the whole state? I think back about Hurricane Michael in 2018, and some of the talk then was, well, in the Panhandle, they don't have the same building codes that we have in South Florida. So maybe this should be across the board. And at the moment, it's mostly left up to local governments. Are you proposing making that flat across the board in some ways?
Yeah, you know, right now, and we've had bills as it relates to condos to try to sort of increase the actual responsibility and duties and obligations of board members. It's still an overwhelmingly voluntary position with little teeth. And so if the legislature decides in their wisdom to keep it strictly voluntary but and not have a lot of duties that would otherwise attach to elected officials or to government entities, either executive or legislative, then there has to be a notice requirement, at least to an entity that would affect some sort of change. We're all reading reports, obviously, that there was a 2018 engineering study on this building, but then you're asking the residents themselves to take on and see what type of appetite there is economically to begin some of the repair processes or renovations or whatever is necessary. And if you're sort of self-policing that situation, then it can become very dangerous, and people can be very lax if they're more concerned about the short term. So I absolutely think that we need some uniformity. After Andrew, the Florida building codes changed a lot, but Danny, we're talking about buildings that from the mid to late 70s into the 80s were built during a time where the pace of construction far outpaced the ability and technical abilities, I think, and best practices that we see today.
So condominiums are regulated under Florida Statute 718. I won't go into too much details, but there are seven parts of it covering everything from the rights of developers and associations to the process of sale and how sales happen. how much does Florida lay out the legal responsibilities of repairs and the consequences for when repairs are not addressed for those condo boards or condo associations?
Not nearly enough. It's a lot of procedure and process, but not a lot of duty and obligation. It lays out something, it lays out a number of things in an attempt for uniformity, but there's way too many carve-outs. You know, our bills over the past couple of years have sought to make the same requirements for 200 unit buildings as we have for 100 unit buildings, for 70 unit buildings. And a lot of the issues, we hear complaints every day about condos. Typically it's about the production of records or election situations or artificially suppressing association fees without being fiscally responsible for necessary reserves for things like this. A couple of years ago in the legislature, it came back up again, rather a perennial effort by some to contemplate the installation and retrofit of wet sprinkler systems in older buildings. You know, I say nobody wants to be the legislator who votes no on a bill that would mandate the installation of fire suppression wet sprinkler systems. But at the same time, you know, the more practical sort of result of that mandate is a very costly, some upwards of $10,000 or $12,000 per unit, which may displace a lot of people who are on fixed income. So it's that sort of balancing test. And what we really need to do is take a look at insurance companies' process with their actuaries and their engineers. They price risk. And as they're in the business of making money, not losing money, they're going to price risk accordingly. And we need to obviously take a hard look at things at buildings and at sites that would create greater, you know, for them it's liability, for us it's tragedy, and find a balance between the two. We certainly don't want to just mandate a number of things across the board that capture on, you know, any type of hysteria. I have people that call us and reach out to us who are in buildings that are 5 years old, you know, where there's no concern whatsoever. You know, am I safe? We're talking about basically a metric or a scoring system for a group of buildings statewide that were built during a certain era using certain design and construction materials in certain places that just don't have the same type of footing and foundation and, you know, pilings, and not concerned and considerate of the subsurface conditions. The very first real condo collapse catastrophe was in Cocoa Beach, Florida, March 27th, 1981. Built in and around the exact same, you know, time and calendar year, obviously, as these Champlain towers. Now, the one to the south in Surfside that is partially collapsed, it's, you know, we heard from a former superintendent that there were recurring daily episodes of water intrusion, that they were using pumps to get the water out all the time. However, its sister building to the north, which is of immediate concern, obviously, for a lot of people, built the same time, same developer, same contractor, was actually dry in the parking area in the lower level. So not every place is the same. We just obviously need to be considerate.
We're speaking with State Senator Jason Pizzo, whose district includes Surfside. He's been on the scene for most parts of a week now and is pushing for changes in state law to prevent this from ever happening again. Senator, there was a special legislative session in May so that the Florida legislature could vote on a new gambling deal between the state and the Seminole Tribe of Florida. Is there any kind of appetite for calling a special session to address construction safety and regulatory issues that have come to the forefront here in Surfside?
The only situation where I think it would be necessary is if we meet with resistance. So, you know, Mayor Caba has announced efforts for buildings over five stories and, you know, in this recertification process or near it to be immediately examined. Now, if there's pushback and resistance, where, you know, people are sort of playing games with, you know, who's in charge and what the rights and authority are of any particular entity, then it's something I think that to be taken a look at. I don't think anyone really right now is not expressing, you know, being receptive and amenable to having building inspections and getting on it right away. And there's nothing that prevents, you know, residents, condo owners are sort of like a mutual company. They're responsible for, you know, for each other. And for their the physical condition of their property, nothing's preventing them from taking, you know, prudent proactive steps about inspections or repairs on their building. So if we met with large scale resistance, then obviously we would seek to put the pressure both of the legislature and perhaps the governor's office upon them.
So I poked around the state budget the other day, and I found that the full budget for the part of the state government that provides oversight to condo associations and boards, the division of condo of Florida condominiums, it's about $7.5 million. And millions of Floridians live in condos. So I'm wondering, does that number and that amount of oversight over condo boards and associations, does that part of this need to be looked at?
It's ridiculous. And I've said it since the first day that I got elected. It's ridiculous. So condo owners, even like mobile homeowners, pay a few dollars a year into a fund that gets raided every year by the legislature during budget time to go pay for other projects. And at one point, you know, with rampant condo issues, not obviously the catastrophe we're seeing here, but, you know, the production of records, lawsuits and elections issues and unsavory behavior. There was a grand jury report out of Miami-Dade County several years ago that spoke to a lot of these abuses and unethical behavior. And the Department of Banking Professional Regulation, under which the Division of Condominiums resides, you know, has a rather, I'll call it, anemic level of actual investigators. At one point, I think there was only 38 statewide. Now, you look at the ratio of what a police department is to a population, or what the city officials and the, you know, executive structure administration of a city is compared to its in proportion to its population. To have like 30 or 40 investigators statewide, and then to also raid their budget. There's at one time, I think, five arbitrators that handle the resolution of disputes between condo owners and condo boards. There's over 4.5 million condos in Florida. And so it's basically something where Florida has just for so long bent over backwards to incentivize development and basically to be completely subservient to, you know, sort of go it alone and to property rights, as opposed to I'm not a huge fan of overregulation, but we're talking about life safety issues. We need to keep the money in there, probably need a couple more bucks per person, and we need to run this right. It's been one of the things that I've loathed the most since coming into office is how poorly and without any real consideration, without real sort of sense of priority that this division has.
And you mentioned the grand jury investigation that the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office released in 2017. I did read through that the other day. And, you know, it's frustrating, I suppose, from a citizen and resident perspective, because that investigation found widespread small scale corruption in condo associations and a lack of government oversight. And when you put those two things together, when you have condo associations saying we need to put X amount of money into these repairs, the small scale corruption is so well known here that there's almost knee-jerk pushback to it, because people don't know what's being done with the money and there's so little oversight. So with that being the case, how do you make the case to constituents that this is something that they should take more seriously, and to the government that they need to have more oversight over it?
Yeah, I don't need to make the case to my constituents. They're fully on board. I need to make the case to my colleagues in the Senate and counterparts in the House. Not to be flippant or sarcastic, there's overwhelming support for my constituents as it relates to transparency. The bills that we've had the past couple of years that have had some movement in the Senate, really none in the House, speak to transparency and production of records. You know, I see when we go around the site area, I'm going from City Hall, sometimes to Shul, to the community center, to the family reunification, which has now moved to another location, to the scene itself, from the south side, the north side. I'm going in this rotation, and I'm thinking to myself, our bills just called very simply for the production of records. But while I'm sitting in the clerk's office in Surfside City Hall, and I'm seeing old building plans and stacks of paper that need to be scanned and uploaded or sent to fulfill public information requests from the media, our bill called for all of this just to be scanned already and already available to every resident, you know, with a username and password, to be up there.
And you're speaking about public records of these condo associations and the records that they keep, but making it more public.
Right. So the grievance of most of the condo owners and constituents we have is that they'll ask for itemized financials about a particular project that's being contemplated, or, you know, how money's spent, how elections are run, just the day-to-day operation records of a condo. The process right now is basically like you have to wait 10 days after giving notice, and then there's an appointment that's provided for you to go and inspect. But very often it could be opening up a closet or a storage area and say, go ahead, go find what you're looking for. And our bill speaks specifically to, and it seems labor intensive in the beginning, but it saves thousands of man hours and disputes going back and forth. I'll give you an example. We had a town hall for condo owners a couple of years ago with then Secretary Halsey Beshears. And we had one married couple that came from the Boca View Condominium Association, 72 units, about a $550 a month association fee. And they came to vent their frustration that asking for records, they had to sue to get them, which goes to arbitration, and then it can be appealed and all that stuff. Meanwhile, this 72 unit condo, not of, you know, high super luxury means whatsoever, the law firms for the association rack up bills of $70,000, $100,000, $200,000 just because somebody's just asking for production of records. It's absolutely ridiculous. And then the residents have to pay for those legal fees. So you're sort of, you know, paying yourself or some part of it. So very simply, in a per se, you know, non-emotional fashion, I wanted every and all building records and documents scanned and placed online. The secretary at the time and the new incoming secretary was also very receptive, Julie, to allowing the department to host it if you have a small condo that's fiscally constrained and, you know, doesn't want to do a hosting service or a website, whatever. But everything should be available and open, you know, to the public, to the residents' view, for those records. And then you get in situations where if you had seen, you know, reports, engineering reports, recommendations, requirements, whatever, and they're not fulfilled, you have something to point to.
President Joe Biden is meeting with Governor Ron DeSantis and Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava right now, actually, basically, as we speak. Would you like to see federal pressure applied on the state of Florida to address some of these concerns if there is pushback that of the type that you've been saying could be coming?
I mean, it's great to have everybody on board, but like I said earlier, there's nothing that prevents sort of self-help remedies as long as they're satisfying it. So it's along the different hierarchy and levels and layers of bureaucracy. You can have a county that wishes to be very proactive, and maybe there's state resistance. So that's when you would ask for federal help. Perhaps there's a state that wants to be very proactive, and you have locations. So then you get into situations where, you know, they become mandates and they preempt local control. So we have to see how it plays out. But I'm hopeful, you know, that people don't have short-term memories even in government, and this is the time to capture and capitalize.
And last question quickly, is there any state that you're aware of that does seem to be doing this in a way that you would like to see emulated in Florida? Or is this kind of brand new territory here?
Well, Danny, I think, you know, Florida's sort of version of getting it right and not letting this happen again came after Andrew with the Florida building code changes after 1992. But again, we're speaking of things that predate those catastrophes, whatever. So, you know, there was a little bit of change, I think, in the 70s, and then more change after the Cocoa Beach disaster in 81. And then Hurricane Andrew really sort of catapulted us into a number of proactive changes. You know, California changed stuff based on earthquakes, and, you know, buildings and insurance companies and developers did things, you know, a little differently in New York after 9/11. So unfortunately it takes tragedies to unite people on better ideas. Florida is a unique situation geologically, you know, physically. We're constantly under the elements, and it's something we need to do now.
Democratic State Senator Jason Pizzo's district includes Surfside. He's been talking with us. Senator Pizzo, thank you so much for coming on. I know you've been very busy.
Thank you, Danny. Thanks very much.
Still to come, the Jewish community in Surfside has come together to support the family members of victims. We hear from the rabbi of a nearby synagogue. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. The community of Surfside is home to a large Jewish population. which continues to grieve the lives lost in the Surfside condominium collapse. An estimated 50 people of the 145 that remain missing are expected to be Jewish. The Shul of Bal Harbor is less than a mile from the site of the Champlain Towers' south devastation. The synagogue is run by Rabbi Shulam Lipskar, who started it 40 years ago. Lipskar has been working with the grieving families, and the shul has been providing meals for the rescue workers on site. WLRN reporter Veronica Saragovia spoke with Rabbi Shulam Lipskar last night. The rabbi started the conversation with his early experiences moving to Surfside.
Rabbi, can you tell us about the Jewish community of this area? What is it like for people who don't get to come here much?
Once in a while, there was a house in Surfside where people would meet for a minyan on Saturdays. But otherwise, there was no Jewish community to speak of. There was a non-Jewish community, a very assimilated Jewish community. In fact, when I first came here, my welcome was, "Who asked you to come? Why don't you go back where you came from?" Literally, it was not such a great welcome from a lot of people. But it took a very short while until they realized that Jewishness is a meaningful, warm way of life. And slowly people started to participate. And we started very elementary level. You know, we had to mark our sitters. We had to have everything in English because people didn't know how to read Hebrew and they didn't know how to pray. And we had to put together a minyan. And one of the great things for a minyan actually was the fact that we had a great kiddush. You know, Jewish people love having a kiddush. So Saturday we had a great kiddush. And slowly people started getting more involved. I remember our first minyans during the weekdays, there was only two of us every morning, but we were there, two of us. That's all there was, myself and one other person in the basement of a hotel. And then there were three of us, and then we started our classes, and our class started with three and four and five and 10. And slowly people told people that it's interesting, and they started coming, participating. And we started having Shabbos in our home. For Shabbat, we didn't live here, but we started making Shabbat here. And when we started making Shabbat together, it was for at least 4 or 5 years that every Shabbat we had people around our table. And it started with two people around a table, three people around a table. Finally, every Shabbat we had like 20, 30, 40, 50 people around our table. And it became like a happening place. A lot of young people started moving in. A lot of single people started seeing it and recognizing that there's something about this way of life that means something positive. It wasn't just being Jewish because of culture or because you had to do something. It was because it was a way of life that worked. It had a history, it had a depth, it had a philosophical system to it. It was a really a powerful way. And the language that the Lubavitcher Rebbe had imbued in us was a language that was extremely advanced in terms of the levels of knowledge of the period, because even people who were very scientific and so forth, Jewishness fit into that pattern very well. And people who were very modern, Jewishness fit into that pattern very well. And there was no judgment, which means, you know, we didn't say, you know, you got to dress one way or dress another way. We never asked questions, where you come from, what's, you know, why don't you dress a different, everything was accepted. If you were Jewish, you had a Jewish soul, you were welcome. And pretty soon, many of these young families, they met each other and they married each other. And all these families moved into the community.
And the community is diverse, right? In fact, a lot of Latin American Jews.
They started really a really powerful community. Now, there was part of the community that was here from before, which were most people that had either summer homes or American homes. They came from South America. They had apartments here. And they had become very close friends of mine. And they were great supporters, but they were not part of the community as a whole because they didn't live here, most of them. They lived to other countries. They would come here for short periods of time, you know, in the summer, in the winter, during holidays and so forth. So there was some interaction, and they supplied a lot of the, thank God, financial support. And there were a few Jews in the community that were also very special, who set this financial foundation for the shul. One of them is a Sam Greenberg from Canada. Another one is Sammy Rohr from Colombia, which is part of your end of the country, of the world. And Evelyn Katz, his daughter, and Shmuel and his other daughter, and the Tabasinic family. You know, so the young family started to move in and they started having children. And so it was an exponential kind of a growth. And pretty soon it required to have other kind of services. So once we built our shul, we had a mikvah, we had children's programs, we had adult programs, we had a preschool. And restaurants opened up. We have the finest kosher restaurants in America, or maybe in the world here. And today, for example, even in the midst of this pandemic, and in the midst of this horrific calamity that's taking place, we have no room in the shul. As you may have seen, we're building a big extension. So the present shul has really outgrown its facility that people never believed it would happen, because it was a big shul in the beginning. But right now, thank God, it has outgrown its facility. And still we have, you see a lot of tents in front of the shul. Have you come by there? The reason the tents are there is because we have no room for the kids. There's over 300 kids in our day camp. So there's a really active process. And then another very important factor is people don't realize it, but people need to grow. They need to learn. They can't remain stagnant. And so when you're constantly having classes, like we have a fully accredited college, we have like 40 classes a week, and we have children's classes and adult classes and classes for all ages and the classes in all languages. We have classes in Spanish, we have classes in French, we have classes in Hebrew, we have classes in English, obviously. And so, and in Portuguese. So there's, and I told you French, I mentioned to you. So there's classes in all kinds of languages. We have in our shul, for example, we have our regular shul, and we have a Sephardic synagogue under the same roof. So there's, it indicates a real unity, a real interactive cultural relationship. And Jewishness has become really, instead of a religion, it's become a way of life.
Jews weren't welcome in Bell Harbor when you first moved there. Can you describe how that's changed?
It's so incredible how much it's changed. You can't believe, because when we first came here, my son would go down to the water to sit. And then he came home one day, he was 8 years old. He says, Daddy, he says, I don't understand. He says, the man who's in charge of the waterfront said, I can't be here. I asked him why. He says, because you're Jewish. He didn't understand, the 8-year-old kid. He says, or he was playing with the mayor's son, and the mayor's son said to him, Salmon, you better go home because my father doesn't like Jews. Or you have eggs thrown at your house. I mean, it was really, we really felt that we got to make a difference here. And it's now totally transformed. You know why? Because like Begin said, you can break my leg, but you can't bend my knee.
Tell us about the aspects of Judaism that mandate helping during hardships and bringing people in when they don't have family.
Number one, it's just a great community. Because, you know, when you have a community where a lot of the people have come back to their Jewishness, there's a warmth and they want to share it. So they've already accustomed themselves to such kindness. And right now, for example, every Sabbath, we used to have a Shabbat in our house every week for like 500 weeks. Now, in every single house on Shabbat, there are guests. There's no such thing as not having a guest for Shabbat. So everybody, it's normal. In America, if you want to bring a guest to your house for a dinner, you have to invite him a week in advance or 2 weeks in advance. You know, you have to prepare yourself. You know, I wasn't ready for this. Here, you invite them Friday night to come for dinner. And it's not just like a very up neighborhood or very, you know, it's a very integrated neighborhood. And people really feel like a community. Like, you know, in South America, you had a community. Like on Sunday, everybody went to the Jewish center. So if you hear Shabbat, our shul is like that place. Everybody comes to shul just to hang out. In fact, they don't leave after that prayer. And our shul, they hang out till 2 o'clock, you know. you'll come to shul every Shabbat, you'll see 100 carriages and scooters and 200 kids. And there's as many women as men in shul, which is usually very highly unusual. And we're not talking about Bar Mitzvah Shabbos. We're talking about just on a regular Sabbath. So that's what created the community. So in good times, that's great. And in challenging times, it's also very helpful to have this kind of integration, because the kindness that has extended from the community is the only one thing that has been helpful in this case with all the people that we're dealing with.
Were many of the people who are still missing or who have died in the collapse of the Champlain Tower South members of the shul?
There's no many people that live that are members of the community, but many people that we knew. Or someone new, because of the community, it's all integrated. It's all like all together. It's all one. So, for example, the shul now is supplying food, clothing, everything that they need. You know, everything, literally, place to sleep. And we are addressing the non-Jewish community the same as the Jews. You know, there are about 35 Jewish people that were in that calamity, and 125 non-Jewish people. And I'll tell you just a little story that happened the other day. I've told a few people. It was very emotional to me, because you know sometimes the Jewish people, we only take care of the Jewish. And we have a different attitude. We have a great relationship with the entire community. So the other day I was walking back to the hotel. It was on Sunday, and there was a couple walking towards me, a bunch of people walking away, and this lady I never saw her before. She says, "Hello, Rabbi, thank you very, very much." And the man says to me also, "Thank you so much." And I knew they were like, must have been South American because of their accent. I said, "Thank you so much." And she says, "Oh, can I hug you?" So I said to him, "What happened?" So he says to me, "I want you to know," he says, "I'm not Jewish. And my wife and I," he says, "we got just the worst news that they found our son who is not alive. But I'll never be able to thank you enough." He said, "I'll never think about the Jewish people differently. I've never seen anything like this." He says, "I love the Jewish people. Can I please give you a hug?" And he was crying and hugging me. And, you know, so to me, that was something that we are a light to the nations. That's one of our obligations. So that's just to give you a perspective of the community not only being insular and dealing with our own people, so to speak, but dealing with the needs of a community at large. When the Rebbe sends an emissary of his, like the Rebbe sent us to this community as a representative, he says, "You are responsible for taking care of the community on every level, spiritually and materially." So he says, "And before you take care of them spiritually, before you ask a Jew if he wants to put on tefillin, you know what that is?" He says, "Before you ask a Jew you want to put on tefillin, ask him if he's hungry."
And what brought you to this part of South Florida originally?
We lived here for 10 years before that. I was a principal of a school, the head of a school. And before that, I was a student in New York. We lived there for a year. I got married there, but I'm a Canadian, actually. And we made really strong inroads in the community. One of my very close friends, and they always thought he was an anti-Semite, but one of my very close friends was the owner of the Bell Harbor shops. And he passed away. When he passed away, I was the only, he didn't have a priest there. He only wanted myself there to take care of him. They asked him about the Bell Harbor shops. It was an interview. He says, "Is this the most important institution in the area?" He says, "Well, the Bell Harbor shops," he says, "and the shul." So they asked him, "What's more important?" He said, "The shul." So, you know, when the owner of the Bell Harbor shops tells you that the shul is more important, it means it's made an impact on him.
How has the shul responded to this catastrophe?
We were at the site to make sure that everything was going well. We had people that were at the site, God forbid, when a body was taken out, to make sure that it's done with dignity, with respect. you know, and we kind of pushed it very strong because at the beginning was chaos. And, you know, nobody was expecting the tragedy. Nobody was expecting the tragedy. And this outpouring, I mean, they've seen things before. I mean, these people are not Jewish. There's a church in the neighborhood. There are a couple of churches. There was no outpouring of love. There's a bunch of orphans whose breadwinner went down in the building. They have nothing. Young kids. They have nobody to support them, nothing. So we're going to have to take some responsibility there. There are people that left their house. They have nothing, no clothes, no apartment, nothing. You have to help them through with housing. So there's so many factors. I mean, believe me, we've raised quite a bit of money. I hope it'll be enough. I don't think it will be.
What can you leave us with? So many people are struggling with this catastrophe. Do you feel hope?
Hope is a very interesting phenomenon because hope is not just hoping for what's going to happen in the future. Hope is a present emotion and it helps you now. It's not only what's going to happen, because even when it didn't happen, God forbid, but the fact that you had hope allowed you to live through that moment with a little bit of a semblance of normalcy. Without hope, it's nothing. And in order to have hope, you have to have spirituality. You have to believe in something higher because that's the reality. So I would leave people with thinking that we need to get a little closer to our spiritual reality because the body is temporary on every level. At some point, that body leaves and our soul has to go into another house. The house is used up. So the soul is forever. And who we really are is our souls. Our bodies are just the suit that our souls live in.
That was Rabbi Shulam Lipsker speaking with WLRN's Veronica Saragovia. A special thanks to reporter Tim Padgett for assisting in producing the interview. You can hear more about support efforts for the Surfside community by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. We'll be carrying a live press conference of President Biden speaking in Surfside today, which is scheduled to begin at 3:50 p.m. today. Still to come, we switch gears and Governor DeSantis signs a bill that overrides an overwhelmingly popular set of ballot proposals in Key West. What it means and where the city goes from here. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero filling in for Luis Hernandez. Voters in Key West passed a series of ballot initiatives in November that would have severely rolled back the number of cruise ships visiting the city. And then the Florida legislature stepped in with a law that undid all of those ballot measures. Governor DeSantis signed that bill into law this week, angering local voters in the southernmost city. Joining us now to talk about this is Nancy Klinginer, who covers the Florida Keys for WLRN and who lives in Key West. Nan, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Danny.
So what has the response been from leaders in Key West to this law that was signed this week by Governor DeSantis?
Well, the mayor told me she was disappointed but not surprised that the governor signed the law. And generally, the commission, you know, they voted unanimously for a resolution during the legislative session that said they didn't like the state legislature overturning local rules. And they specifically pointed out these charter amendments that the voters approved last November.
And can we go back just for a second and can you remind us what these three ballot measures were that were passed by Key West voters?
Yeah, they limited the number of people who could visit Key West by cruise ship to 1,500 a day maximum. They limited the capacity of ships that could call here, cruise ships, to ships that carry 1,300 people. And they said the city should prioritize ships with the best health and environmental safety records.
And if nothing changes from here moving forward, we'll get into that a little in a minute. But if nothing changes now, how soon could cruising come back to Key West at this point?
Well, as soon, I guess, as the cruise lines could make it happen, because as it stands now, we're the same position we were in before these charter amendments were approved. The law, that's the law of the land now. The nearest ship on the ship's agent calendar is September 2nd.
So in 2 months. Yeah, basically 2 months.
Yep.
And just going back, what was it that led the citizens and the residents of Key West to build up the momentum to pass these three measures, which, you know, cruise ships have been coming to Key West for a long time? Can you just lay us out what happened leading up to this?
Yeah, I mean, cruise ships have been a contentious issue in Key West for a long time. And even back in 2013, there was a referendum about whether they should do a study on dredging the harbor and the ship's channel to allow for bigger ships. And that referendum failed by 3-1. So there was fairly strong sentiment in Key West already that that the cruise industry was too big here, that it was overwhelming the downtown. And then when the pandemic happened, if you remember, a lot of those early outbreaks were on cruise ships, and there was a lot of concern down here that, oh, you know, we have one hospital for the lower 50 miles of the Keys, and that this could be overwhelmed if there was an outbreak in this small community. And also that, you know, they do have an effect on the environment, and people don't like that.
I'm speaking with WLRN's Monroe County reporter Nancy Klingener. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis recently signed into a law a preemption preventing the city of Key West from restricting the size of cruise ships coming in. You can find more on Nan's reporting at our social media at WLRN Sundial. So Nan, when the Florida legislature went into session, they started taking aim at these votes that happened in Key West. What were the arguments used by the state government in limiting or rolling back these local votes?
Yeah, they said basically that the voters of Key West didn't have the authority to regulate shipping like this. And they pointed out also that the state provides money to the city to maintain some of its port facilities.
And have you spoken to residents after this new law was passed about how they feel about what the legislature has done?
Yeah, I've spoken to a few, and I've seen a lot of chatter on social media, and a lot of people are really unhappy. They feel like, you know, their voices about their community have been completely ignored and overridden.
And, you know, we're going on probably about a year and a half now without cruise ships coming into Key West because of COVID, you know, besides these ballot measures. How is the local economy faring?
The local economy is going gangbusters. We have the lowest unemployment in the state at 3.1%. The sales tax collections in the city of Key West for April compared to 2 years ago, so before the pandemic and before that checkpoint when the Keys were closed, are 135% over what they were in 2019. And that's without cruise ships, and that's without international travelers.
That's pretty significant.
Yeah. The average daily rate for a room in Key West in May was more than $400.
So that is significant. Are people arguing or making the argument that the Key West is actually doing better without cruise ships?
Some people are. There's also a feeling that Key West is, in the Keys in general, are doing so well because people can't go to the Caribbean.
Right.
So there's some thought that that might tail off.
And the Key West City Commission is planning a meeting next Thursday, July 6th, to discuss next steps in kind of responding to this law that just went into effect.
Yeah, it's actually Tuesday, Danny.
Tuesday. Yeah, I thought I said Tuesday. But what can we expect from that meeting?
I think we're going to hear a lot of frustration from residents. The mayor says she really hopes that everyone comes to the meeting, including people like the harbor pilots, who are obviously in favor of cruise ships. So we're going to hear, and she said we're going to hear from the city's attorneys about what the city can legally do. The mayor says she believes the commission is going to do everything they can to have these restrictions put back into place. And interestingly, that bill that the governor signed, it doesn't say the city can't regulate cruise ships, it says you can't do it by voter initiative. And in this case, the city owns the port, so the commission is, in fact, the port authority.
So they can do something, potentially.
Yeah.
Nancy Klinginer covers the Florida Keys for WLRN, and she is always on the beat. Nan, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Danny.
And that's Sundial for July 1st. Sundial's senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovaya is our producer and social media editor. Kristen Moorhead is our intern. Our engagement editor is Katie Leprey. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Mares. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. Go to at gopalo.com. You can download a podcast of this program by searching WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. The program is made possible in part by support from the Miami Cancer Institute. We'll be back with more live shows next week.